Hello and welcome to There's No Business Like, a podcast where friends and industry colleagues explore topics and interview leaders in our industry of professional theatrical touring.
Welcome back. I'm Brian Zellmer from KU Presents in Kutztown, Pennsylvania, and I'm here with my friends, Danielle.
Hi, it's Danielle Van Hook from the Alden in McLean, Virginia.
Katie.
Hi, Katie Miller with the Midland Center for the Arts in Midland, Michigan.
Josh.
Josh Benson in Marion, Illinois at the Marion Cultural and Civic Center.
And Kevin.
Kevin Maynard at Quad City Arts, splitting the border between Iowa and Illinois.
So after doing this episode with Jiyu and Kim, I started thinking a lot about traditions that we have in our industry and how some of them are changing or have changed or need to change. We used to be so strict in our theater about no photography, but lately so many artists are asking the audience to take out their phones and take a picture during the show. And it's driving some of my staff crazy, or some of the patrons that like those traditional ways, and they get so angry, like, they have their phones out, they'll come to me during a show. And I'll say, the artist wants it. I can't really do much about it. They ask them to do that. So I'm just curious if you guys have any stories like that about changes with traditions that you're facing in the industry or in your family life or in your work.
You know, Brian, first thing that came to mind is with my family traditions. Like, I've got a pretty large family, and now as everybody's getting older and adding more people to that family, we used to, like, around Christmas, everybody would get a present for everybody, and it just became like too unmanageable. But also, like, I got older, and it got to a point where, like, I'm very fortunate in my life, and that most of the reasons that I don't have something, it's because I can't afford it. So I'm not going to ask somebody else to afford it. And so the past few years, like, we have kind of moved away from that, but moved more into, like, just getting together, like, doing some sort of experience. And that, for some folks in my family, has been a bit of a, you know, a bit of a kerfuffle. But for most people, like, we've just really have enjoyed that much more.
When I came into this job, I still felt very strongly about the fourth wall, and we needed to set up an environment that, like, did not break the fourth wall, and that when children came to the theater, they needed to, like, learn how to be theater patrons. That lasted for like a month until we did like a meet and greet, and being able to see the artists and the children interact in that way and, like, making it so much more alive and being able to experience make-believe and also real life and see the difference between the two, like, I feel like helps them understand better what they just watched and, like, what goes into theater creation and, like, why it's different than other types of media. I think that was, like, the beginning of all of the various large and small things that I've said to myself over the years of, like, well, why are we doing it like this?
For me, there's a couple of theater traditions. One, as a lighting designer and somebody that helped to create the shows for a long while, I have always hated the main curtain. And not using a main curtain in a show is my standard. And that's my favorite, like, traditional theater thing that I really hate and wanted to get rid of. Granted, we still have one because we're a rental facility and some of the times you need one. But I still hate it. Additionally, like, getting out of the overall, like, season booking mode and getting into a 365 year-round booking schedule has been a big step forward for us here. It provides so much more opportunity for commercial artists because commercial artists don't book so often on a standard PAC schedule. And so flipping that and getting rid of the tradition of just putting out a season and doing a season announce and a season launch has been really beneficial for us.
Some of the theater traditions or expectations that I have been working to rethink and dismantle within my own institution are around the expectations around audience behavior. So thinking about dress code, thinking about how people are showing up in spaces, but particularly around trying to help audiences understand that they are not entitled to police other audience members' behavior, particularly when it comes to those who are coming to the theater for the first time, or individuals that might have, you know, needs, accessibility needs. Patrons, for whatever reason, feel entitled to shush other patrons or tell them to sit down and be quiet or complain directly to them versus taking their concerns to an usher or to a staff member. And no one should ever feel entitled to make somebody else feel poorly in a creative space such as a theater or a museum or an outdoor amphitheater or something like that, because everyone should feel welcome enough to show up exactly how they are. So we talk about our spaces being a judgment-free and a shush-free zone, particularly when children are involved, but even spaces like our symphonic orchestra concerts and things like that. So really helping people understand that these are friendly, welcoming places. And if they really, truly have an issue, like someone is acting rudely versus using a communication device or using hearing protection, like those are concerns that they should take up with staff and staff will address them versus them feeling like, oh, I can just do whatever I want because I paid for a ticket. That's inappropriate and people shouldn't feel entitled to police others. So we're really working on creating welcoming and friendly spaces for everybody to come and experience the arts.
So thanks for sharing that, everybody. I had a great conversation with Dr. Ji-Yoon Kim, who is a professional pianist and has so many amazing things to say. And we talked about some of the changes to the traditions that happen in the classical musical world. And I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Hi, I'm classical pianist Ji-Yoon Kim. My mission is create a bridge between me as a performer and the audiences. So this magical and powerful portion of classical music is more accessible to the 21st century audiences.
Hi, Ji-Yoon. Thank you for joining us today and taking time to be on the podcast. For the listeners that don't know you, just to quickly run down, you've been recognized with many awards and critical adulations as a pianist, also as an educator. You have an undergraduate degree, two master's degrees and a doctorate degree. And you also published a book, you have your own podcast, and you perform and on and on and on, so many things. But I just wanted to maybe start with your background. I read that you started playing piano in Korea when you were 4 years old and just wondered how you went from that early beginning to where you are now, just maybe on a journey of the highlights along the way.
To make a long story short, I was lucky enough to somehow knew when I was 4 years old, I loved music. And my parents didn't push me in any way. I went to piano institute on my own.
At 4 years old.
4 years old. You know,
I just have to stop you a second because I have four children and I can't imagine any of them when they were four, having the attention span or the discipline to do that. That's amazing. Yet alone know that's what you want to do.
I know. I think it amazes me too, in a way that looking at this new generation is different culture, different environment. I was lucky enough that my parents were, how can I say, they were busy. They did care, but they didn't really micromanage. And that time, you enroll kids to Piano Institute, which means you go every single day. And you decide when to go. And I went there. And now I think about it, I roam around to the alleys to get to the institute with my backpack on, just roaming around. Eventually, I ended up being in the Piano Institute and took maybe, you know, 10 minutes a lesson every day, but about 30 minutes practice at the institute. When I came back home, I didn't really practice at home. And that system, I never heard of that system in other countries.
I've never heard of that system. That is incredible.
What was really important lesson that I didn't realize at the time, which is the habit of the importance of discipline. And I had that for the longest time. And I think one of the hardest things as a musician, a freelance musician, is that this is a lifelong journey and nobody, no parents, nor teachers gonna tell you this X, Y, and Z. And eventually you have to manage your daily life. And in daily life, it includes most of times practice. I mean, when I realized what I was doing, I already had a system of how to practice, let's say in middle school or high school, that by that point I had to do it because it becomes so much in my part of system that was easy. It doesn't mean that the environment got easier either, because it started as very just love of it. I was singing. I was actually playing flute. Korea, too, is very competitive environment like any other field. But I faced it much sooner because I majored in piano in art high school. We all play the same repertoire in the piano exam, and the ranking of the piano exam result was on the wall. So you can see like, oh, I'm not on the top one, your first one, or it was very much like comparison between each other, which could be very toxic, especially in the teenager. Although music cannot never be numerically ranked, as a human, we all try to organize things and put it in the box. And that early on, that system of education system, I think they had to do it, just push ourselves. I found it is really too much for the teenagers. But I went through that, and after going through all of that kind of severe competition between each other. I actually went through a very difficult personal life with my parents divorcing and whatnot. So my piano was my oasis to escape from all of it. And I somehow, you know, sometimes looking back your life and that crisis at that time was blessing because I didn't care about competition with that. I just had to survive. And music provided me that. And after undergrad in Korea, I knew I'm going to go on to the further study because in Korea, even though it's very well-educated country for the classical music's concern, I knew that I had to go to the root because classical music is Western music. And so I decided either Germany or America. And I lived both countries for a month to decide which country. And eventually I learned that America allowed me to be who I am more, much more freely than Germany. And in fact, most of the great European teachers actually came to America to teach in the institute. So I decided to come to America. And even then, I didn't know what I'm going to do with piano. All I knew was I have this hunger. I need to become better pianist. I want to know more. And it was just a natural transition to Indiana University because the teacher was just so amazing. And I wanted to study. And I just study and study. And after doctorate.
Before you decided that you needed a doctorate, was it because you knew you wanted to teach? Or was it because I met you as a performer, a performing artist, and you don't need a doctorate to perform. I'm just curious how that path was like in your brain.
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. I think if you ask majority of doctorate students why you're doing doctorate, maybe there might be some of people that saying, yes, I do want to go to the professorship and get a job there. But a lot of it, it's not enough of education that I got. I feel I need to learn more in order to be a performer. I thought about it. What is it? What does it take? And part of it is actually winning the major competitions. But the age limit, you have to start at early 20s. And when you are like 23 already, you're late in the game. And often those competitions, you have to perfect it, the certain repertoire for years. And you see the same people hit the same major competitions. And, you know, it's a part of the luck too. And for those 4 or 5 years of you hitting the same competition over and over again, if you win once, game over, hopefully, but not really, but it's good. But if you don't, then what? I always thought that, yes, that's one way of to become pianist, quote, quote, but that was such a lottery ticket that I cannot imagine myself betting on that. But I wanted to bet myself to become good musician, good pianist, and let's see what happens. So I bet myself to get deeper into the study, just dive into it. And you're surrounded by amazing musicians. You talk about classical music, you're surrounded by amazing teachers. And that was unrealistic, you know, oasis that I had to wake up from eventually. But while I was there, I really needed that incubation to be a best musician that I can be at that time. And after doctorate, I realized, okay, I went to the end of the rope from the public's perspective. I went to all the way to the end from the reputable university. So that means you may know. In reality, you realize, there's so much to be learned, but now I know how to find to learn myself, which was biggest learning. It's not like, if I didn't go all the way, I think I might feel like, what would it be like to go through doctorate? What would it be like to go to the end of that rope? Now I went through that. There's no one else to tell me what to do. Then I have to like turn that arrow back to me, like, okay, you have to continue learning on your own, which was the most valuable realization or awakening that I've got. And it's a strength for myself. No one has to tell me that. From the before doctorate, after doctorate, only difference for me was like, you became Dr. Kim, but what does that mean? But internally, I feel like I know how to find the knowledge or dig deeper on some subject or some concept of as far as classical music concerned.
So you finish your doctorate and now you're out of this oasis and into the real world, what did you do with it? Did you have connections that helped you get to the next stage? Or did you have to, like, were you just released and, okay, now go ahead, Dr. Kim, go make something of yourself?
That's interesting. You would think, I never thought what is beyond doctorate, to be honest with you. I thought if I went all the way with this kind of intention, that something would open up. Either, yes, I might land on university, which I have all the credibility, I love teaching, or maybe some agent knock on my door and, you know, I get a contract or whatever. And then the next morning after the graduation, the same sun goes up, same breakfast, and I realize, oh my gosh, nothing automatically happens to me. I have to look for it. I have to be very proactive. And that realization was that very depressing. Nowadays, people equip students, music students, a little better, but you can never be equipped enough what you ended up facing, which is you all alone in the world with that degree. And degree doesn't protect you from anything. I had to find some concerts and create a concert, and not in a major way, but by doing it, I learned normal audiences are not the piano major's audience that I used to have. They're a totally different kind of audience. And I have to walk through the valley from the oasis to the real world and have a reality check of, oh my gosh, the public is not the audience that I used to. And from that realization, I also felt that, okay, I have to make myself on my own path, but I still curious, get the curiosity of, I don't know how to teach piano at 4 years old. I can teach something piano majors, the advanced Chopin repertoire, but not 4 years old. That really bothered me after going through the end of the rope. Still, I feel not efficient enough to teach 4 or 5 years old beginners. And that really bothered me. So I went back to the master's degree and people were auditioning me like, oh, aren't you enough? You know, did enough of a degree. And I said, yes.
You had to audition even though you had your PhD.
I had to audition, but they kind of laughed. They laughed at like, what, you know, like you could be one of us sitting right, in here, right? And like, you know, just don't consider that. Consider me as like older age master's degree coming back to it, you know, because I was really older than other master's degree students at the time. And I was really auditioning for piano pedagogy, which is the how to teach piano. And from that 2 years taught me the glue to everything I did for 4 years old up to the doctorate degree, because I learned how to distill the most complicated concept to simplify, more accessible, to be able to deliver as like educator's perspective. If I can teach kids any concept, whatever that could be, then you know that. And that very skill that I learned from pedagogy, practical and very accessible approach to anything I brought into to the stage as a pianist, to my podcast, to my teaching. And in a way, I needed the glue that I didn't know that I needed. Going through that 2 years of master's degree, while I'm figuring out, oh my gosh, this is what I'm going to do as a pianist is ever going to happen, you know?
Have you had any major performances before that master's degree?
The question of how one can get to perform.
Right.
How this person performs. It's like a $1 million question. Nobody tells me so. Nobody tells me how, other than winning a Chopin competition, which is like 0.00000001% of the millions of musicians out there.
So I want to know how you got your first professional gig on your own, your first professional concert. Was that from just knocking on doors, or was it from an introduction at someone saw you at a competition? How did that happen?
You know, unfortunately, my teacher was also not in the real world. So she was like, didn't give me any reference or give me a call. Some teachers do, but my teacher wasn't. You know, she was just good at teaching piano, amazing level, but not context. So I had to find a way. And one of the first one was that, okay, what are the series around me that I can maybe contact? I did the research. Or find a pianist that was not winner of Chopin competition, but there's someone that I don't know, but where do they play? And then go to their website, concert schedule. Oh, where's in Chicago? Where is it? And then so I backtrack some of the professional musicians that they play. So if they accept solo piano, that means they can accept me too. The concert engagement that I got out of nowhere, it was me calling. I'm a graduate of Indiana University. I want to perform there. Can I send you some materials? I felt very self-conscious about doing that on my own, which I do all the time now. But at the time, felt like, oh my gosh, I have to practice and I have to promote myself too. Ridiculous. Like I supposed to have someone else do that. And I felt very much lied to and felt like, this is not my job, but for this time, I will do it because, you know, no one else will do it. And I did that. And then later on, like in 6 months later or something, this person called me back and, are you still interested in like, yes. And that concert just came out of nowhere. No, it's not out of nowhere because I called 6 months prior. But then that was a real concert with paid, not in the same fee range of I'm getting now, but it was still a lot of money for me at the time. But after that, it's not like, okay, now my career starts. If next concert will comes to me. No, nothing happens. After that is dead end silence. That was also hard realization. Like, okay, I worked really hard for this very concert. I did research. I reached out to many people, but that one responded and I get good concert. I enjoyed it. But then afterwards, do I have to do it all over again? Like bothering people?
That seems very daunting to realize that.
Yeah, it feels like there's got to be a better way than this. This is not the way to do it. Like, how in the world other people do it? I realize, okay, I need to be professor because professor seems like university sponsor them to perform. And that's a way to I can get to perform different universities and whatnot. So I thought I'm going to start to apply. And then soon I realized, oh, okay, this is like a beyond lottery too.
Oh, no.
You know, you have to be in the place that like, you want to be. It's not somewhere you don't know, North Dakota. Or somewhere in the far, far countryside in the college. Unless you want really to go there, the possibility of you want to be in the city that you want to live, the college that has become a professorship, that has a potential to be a tenure position, that's like out of your control. And I got actually the final top three of candidates to become a position in somewhere in San Diego. At that time, and I thought, oh, this is it. Oh my gosh, yes, of course they want me. Who else needs the other credential than I do? You know, I really felt like I was confident in what I can offer, and they really need me. They, of course, they do. And then at the end, I was not selected. And it turns out they did have internal candidate all along. The open position was more like a show. And then at that time, I realized, you know what? I don't think a professorship is for me. All of a sudden felt very suffocating that I have to do all the admin stuff, teaching the same class over and over in piano 101. And then they don't even support the performing. They just do it for the score so they can get a tenureship. They don't necessarily have, you know, like all of the other things drain my energy to other people, other musicians, the orchestra job or the university job. We envy that it went outside because it looks very secure. But at the end, if you really talk to those people who have the job, they complain. They're the one of the depressed people. There's a lot of them because they don't like it work environment. They don't like what they actually do. It's almost like they become one piece of the soldier. They don't really shine as what they really want to do. And if they what we want exactly match, they're happy. But it's much rare. That kind of thing mm-hmm. felt like insecure for me. That's actually not secure job because you're mentally not secure. Is that secure enough if you are not happy with what you do? And I realized, you know what? I'm going to ditch all of the idea preposition myself of a security. I'm going to create my own path. That's, I remember the very moment, no adjunct, no teaching in a university, no applying for the job. I'm just going to go completely 100% designing my life the way I want to do.
That's inspiring. Like those words you just said are incredible and I want to write them down. But what does that mean in reality? How do you turn that into making a living?
Exactly. So there's many parts of it. And I have to really, really ask what myself, what do I want to do? And I knew I love teaching, actually, but not full time. All of the things that I want to do, as long as it's not full time, it actually makes me happier. So I thought, okay, I need all these little different baskets of my life completed by all of things that I'm interested in and love to do. I started with why. It's like a company. You need a mission statement. And I, through my master's degree in piano pedagogy, I learned that people don't know classical music or never experience in a correct way. And I, as a classical music fanatic myself, I feel like, why? Why don't you like it? What's wrong with it? If I give them a little bit of a context, just a little bit, like bring them into my living room and play. And before I play, I say, you know, this piece just drives me crazy because it's so heartache, so much heartache. I don't know what it is. Just listen me out and play. Just that sentence. And then they were like, oh my gosh, what is this? It's just like shakes me from the core. Classical music is not the problem. The context is the problem. So I need to give a better context. I want to be a little bit of a different context giver to the audience. So my mission, just like as I said in the earlier, is that I want to become a bridge, whatever that means. I'm not going to do new age music, rock and roll. I'm going to play hardcore piano repertoire, but with a different context. I love teaching, so I built Piano Institute, although this is only me. It's called Dr. Kim Piano Academy, which still exists in San Diego. That's my part-time because I don't teach all year round. I built it from the scratch like a company. I built the website, and even before the first student arrives, as if I have full studio, I said, let me check my schedule if I can accept you for the performer side of it. I needed to have album, just like business card. As a musician, you even if people don't listen to it, it doesn't matter. You need to have some way to present yourself, your music to the world. So I created Kickstarter crowdfunding for my first album, $30,000, which is a lot of money at that time. But I thought, okay, what Sony does, what Deutsche Grammophon does, they have to hire some outsource. Where do they record? Which photographer do they hire? How do they make album? I researched and find the best of the world, and that made it to $30,000 because you can make an album for under $10,000, but I didn't want to do that. I want to do the highest quality that I can do, but only if people want me to. So I presented that I'm going to do this album, which is called 10 More Minutes. I have a concept. And the first thing I had to do was creating, please help me donate to this project video, which was mind blowing. Like, I have to look at the camera and tell them to give me money, which was like, do I really have to do it? And I told the videographer, can you just like, you know, caption it, just donate today, do I have to tell them? Like, because I don't want to tell them. You just told them like my practicing, you know, playing segments or something. They may be inspired. Like, no, it doesn't work. You need to look at the camera, directly ask for money. And I was like, okay. And I had to practice so many times, still making mistakes. And that 30 seconds took so much effort and energy. And I did it. I had to do it because this kind of pledge is you get nothing or everything. It's not in between. If you don't reach the goal, you don't get
it. Right. Spoiler alert, that album exists. So I'm assuming you made your goal.
I did. But it felt like, though, miracle. What I learned is money has message attached to it. That person who donated even $1 to it, it told me that, Ji-Yoon, go for it. Wow, sounds great. I support you. Mm-hmm. And I never thought money as that way. But now, from that experience, if someone is want to do it, I'm the first one who wants to donate because I know how hard that is, how important the money actually activate the energy in the world. And some people's like, well, I support you, but, you know, no action follows versus someone just give me a dollar for this project. Just have a lot more to, you know, love it saying, doing it, right? Than just, I learned it from that process. And interestingly, the people who donate even $1 to it become obsessive fan, lifelong fan of what I do. Interestingly, they pay for it. But they become a fan. Mm-hmm.
And then they buy the CD when it comes out.
I know. It's all ironic circle. But yeah. What I realized also, one of the important lessons that are through that process was that I'm an artist and I am just the facilitator to create an art. And I'm not begging money to buy a bread today, but I am telling people, I have happened to have ability to create an album that I want to share with you that might help you, but I need your help. And when I separate my identity of who I am to the art, it was much easier. Like if they say no, I didn't take it personally, like, oh, no problem. It really, no problem. If someone donated, it's not like they like me personally or none of it. It's like, oh, wow, great. I really appreciate it. So it became like I am another supporter of the art and I'm merely doing my work. And that feeling of selfless, of egoless, and be able to provide to the world. And that's a service mindset became one of the most important things that I do. And, you know, people would always say, all the gurus would say, you know, at first you want to make it as whatever you want to do. And then eventually you will have to find purpose. And if you read any books or any gurus will tell you that that's a way of life. And I felt that there's a truth to it for sure. And even if that's the fulfilling your need or your desire, if you frame it such a way that you help someone else, that makes ultimately one happy. And that's, I think, human is designed to support each other. Humans that cannot live by themselves. And artists are the one that feels often hard to sell themselves, like asking for donation for my project or, you know, asking for concerts even. And now when I talk to presenters, which I'm doing because I'm self-aware presented artist, I don't take it personally. Initially, yes, I feel like, oh my gosh. Now it's more like a matchmaker. You and I maybe not the right match, but someone else desperately wanting me. And when that matched, then we're like sparkles. And when they say no, it's not no to me. It's like, okay, maybe not right timing. We're not the right match. That's all. I do actually have my own agency called Namus Classics. The employees are only me. I've sometimes hired someone to help me with the emails and things, but mostly me. But I do hire a graphic designer, PR person sometimes. I present the big concerts in where I live in San Diego, which is the 700 people call. And I feel the hall. And that takes strategy. So I wear hat as a presenter for that very concert I do every 2 years. From that experience, I know how to market myself, how to present myself professionally, and what audience needs.
Ji-Yoon, I want to go back to something you were talking about earlier with classical music. And I don't know if it's something I read or heard you talk about because I do listen to your podcast, but I know a lot of people think about the audience of a classical music attendee being older and whatnot. And you've done a really great job in engaging with younger audiences. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that, I think, and this is where I don't remember if I read it or heard it, but you attribute that to engaging the audience and speaking to them.
Right.
Whereas I know I've worked with some, you know, quote unquote masters, you know, legends or icons mm-hmm. in the classical world. I won't name names, but just recently we had an intermission and he didn't speak at all. He didn't even look at the audience and, you know, just performed the whole time and then went off stage. And I had one of my major donors was just wondering, could he at least just like say mm-hmm. hi to us? We would love mm-hmm. to hear his voice, you know, just, mm-hmm. And like acknowledge us in some way. And so I went back there. Yeah. I said, I don't know if he will. I went back and I talked to him and I just mentioned what the person said. I said, I'm not asking you to talk, but if you're comfortable, they would love for you, you know, to just say, mm-hmm. you know, to greet them or something. And he loudly just goes, blah, I play music, not talk.
Yeah, so yeah.
I come to understand that that's a very traditional classical kind of mindset. Like right. we're there to play the music, not to speak or to entertain. And so it's so different and refreshing. And I think that's why you're mm-hmm. successful at attracting younger audiences or engaging them to get into the music.
The truth is, I'm talking every aspect of it. It's the audience that has a traditional mindset who goes to classical music concerts, that all of a sudden musicians talk, they may not like it. Or presenters, like, I actually honestly had one presenter, can you not talk?
Really?
Before we signed the contract, and I said, if you don't want me to say it all, maybe we're not the right fit. So I didn't sign the contract. So we're talking very traditional presenters that have their way of doing, dealing
yeah,
things.
Yeah.
And also the artists, musicians think that talking is, well, music should speak itself. And it should. And I heard, you know, I'm the one that who believes in that power more than anyone. But again, we need a context. And I find that the talking aspect of my concert is I practice as much as I practice piano, which means I deliberately plan and kind of correct it, edit it. Oh, it didn't work. That very sentence was not effective. I may share my story of my childhood. Maybe I just say two sentences about the feelings about this piece or the images that comes to my mind or the poetry that I linked or the storytelling. You know, just like you want to hear the story your grandma tells you by the bed, like you not get bored. You'll be like so absorbed by mm-hmm. it. Like, tell me more. Tell me about more of the story. It's the same thing. I think if we bring them down, listen, I'm going to play this piece, but this piece is about love. But the love couldn't make it because it's, you know, whatever. Just two, maybe maximum 3 minutes, not more than that, you know? And mm-hmm. then go into the piece, they were like, now they're understanding what is this piece about. And right. experience is a day and night. When I experienced it with a real audience, I cannot not do it. Like, come on. It's like mm-hmm. you're mm-hmm. missing 90% of audience by not talking. And
right.
then there's a wrong way of talking too, unfortunately. We don't want to know about this composer born in France. And, you know, we don't need a historic kind mm-hmm. of, unless it's related to.
Right. That's something that could be in the program. That could be in exactly. the printed program. You could read about that. Right.
Mm-hmm. I think one of my favorite concerts is to play by my friends because I know them. Like, oh my gosh, that piece speaks to me much more strongly. But if I give them a context of who I am, ultimately they can bypass me and get to the music much more strongly. That's what I do, you know? And so I don't go out to the backstage after each piece. Why? You have to ask yourself, do I really need to go back to a stage and come back in a second, each piece? And you have to ask that question of all the tradition surrounded.
Yeah, that's a very traditional thing.
And,
yeah.
and then I don't need it. If I'm going to take a 10-minute break, yes. But if I'm just going to go backstage and come back right up mm-hmm. for the next piece, I don't need that. So I don't do it. I stay where right. I'm stage.
I don't know if you know this, but we have a time machine. If I brought you back in my time machine to when you're just graduating with your doctorate degree and you get to a few minutes to speak to yourself then, is there any advice or any kind of encouragement that would have helped you or expedited any of that information you could have used at that time?
That's actually a very difficult question because who I am now had to go through all the struggles in order to be who I am now. And if I actually expedited that process, maybe I don't feel as though that was struggle, victory after struggle. So struggle is good. And I will maybe say, it will work out. So don't worry about it, but keep doing it. And I did keep doing. So I don't know that would do change anything, but maybe when I talk to the presenters and on phone calls or numerous emails, rejections, and I was blaming the society or culture or even myself, why do I have to do this? And I think I would tell that Ji-yoon and say, yes, that is your job. This is the 21st century and you make your own path. Mm. That's a really, really powerful thing. Way to go, Ji-yoon. 99% of your fellow musicians, where are they? I don't know. Even after doctorate, where are they? Do they perform? No. Mm. Why? I don't know, because nobody knocked on their doors. So Ji-yoon, what you do is such a powerful thing. And it's a difficult thing to do, but rewarding thing to do. So keep going. I think I would give myself encouragement when nobody was giving me that. And I was myself putting me down that I'm calling a presenter, said, hi, I'm pre-pianist Ji-yoon Kim. And I think, in fact, that this is a part of your job. And in order for you to be happy and to do whatever you want to do in your life. And ultimately, I'm so happy now that all my life, there's no single minute passed by doing something someone else asked me to do. That's like ultimate antidepressant pill that I'm taking every single day, that there's nothing that I do that I don't like to do.
That's great.
Even if in this interview, so it's like, is this a really work or is this a part of like just hanging out, having fun, right?
Right.
So I think everything I do, I feel like, oh my gosh, this time goes like this because it's...
Yes. Time is going like this. And I have to ask you about your book. Can you just maybe talk a little bit about how that book came to be and what it's about and maybe leave us on a cliffhanger so we go buy it?
I know. I think, again, people would think like, okay, you do this X, Y, and Z. And then like writing a book, what in the world, you know?
And to be clear, it's a self-help book. Your musical story is the basis of it, but it's about self-help, correct?
Yeah, it is a self-help book. It is for the general public. It's not for musicians, but musicians to eat up by, you know, with this book. But it's called Whenever You're Ready. And right before I go on every stage, there's a stage manager holding the door to the stage and asking for my cue and say, whenever you're ready. And the very moment I ask myself, am I ready? Will I ever be ready? But at the same time, in the midst of all the doubts, and I create a tremendous amount of courage and strength within myself and make a decision to walk towards a stage. And if then the beautiful stage and audience, enthusiastic audience is waiting for me, and I realize that very brief second of decision-making to walk towards a stage is not happening in that very moment. It's everyday life behind the scenes, a green room of my life, that every day what I do to deal with negativity within myself or from others, or how to discipline myself, how to create a habit, how to awaken my inner child to be more creative, how to connect with myself, to connect with others, or how to take care of my own body. All of it is, it made it into a written concert. It has 5 movements. In between, there's intermission, which I talk about my favorite piece, and there's a QR code that you can listen to my own performance. There's also prelude and encore. You know, I realized I'm not the only one who has a stage. Everyone has a stage called a life. So whenever you are ready to embark something uncomfortable, vulnerable, something unknown, this book might give you a dose of inspiration and courage when you make that decision and nod with smile, yes. So this is a friendly tone, just like you and I have sitting down at a cafe and talk about life. And, you know, there's a lot of self-help books. But sometimes when your friends say, this really works for me, then you're finally like, oh my gosh, I know that, but I'm going to try that now. Because so this book, I think, has that more friendly tone that maybe finally you might do X, Y, and Z that you're putting it off.
That's amazing. And Congratulations, because I saw that it reached number 3 in Korea. You translated it in Korean yourself, and that's amazing. That must feel really good. It's almost like a full circle moment.
I know. It's funny because the book, many authors would agree. I'm not sure. But once you finish the last sentence of the book draft, it's not yours anymore. It has its own entity. Whenever I see it, it comes back to me, or I see it on the bookstore, I feel like, how are you doing? You know, I am become an observer of this book, whatever it does. And my job is actually done by the time that I finish the draft. And I'm happy if it reaches someone else. But if not, it's still my job is done. And I'm happy that I did it. And the Korean version is came out after the English version, which is ridiculous because my native language is Korean. this is the testimonial like product for me, that who am I to write a book? That was the voice that I was hearing. Who would read it? You know, all of the negative voice. But despite all that, I still walked through the uncomfortable valley and made it happen. And Si Ji-yoon, look at it. So that wasn't too bad. Whenever I look at that book, it's a reminder for me that whenever I feel uncomfortable and I'm afraid, that's the very thing that you should face.
Ji-yoon, thank you for spending this time with me. And I have one last question. What do you like most about the performing arts industry today?
Because you emphasized today, which means because I do love performing arts in general, to give people, you know, to connect with the art, which we need in this society. But when you say today, interestingly, the pandemic, in fact, really helped performing arts in a way that we all need to change. We always needed to change, but pandemic pushes us to the edge. We are like, okay, what do I need to do now to actually more open, more connect with people? And people might think that performing arts might go downhill, and I don't think so. The more the society goes downhill, performing arts will rise because people thrive in arts. And as a presenters, as a musician, even as audience, we accept change more easily after the pandemic. So I love right now that all the aspect of artists or presenters, agencies, audiences are okay with the change. And this is a golden opportunity for all of us. Whatever is not working, change it. Like if you don't need to go walk to the backstage, don't do it. Or if you feel like artist needs to talk, do it. And those traditions serve some aspect of in the past, maybe not anymore. So I feel like we're now a little bit more, hopefully, I think, open-minded. So take advantage of it. And that's what I love about when I go to conferences. I think they're a little more humble attitude. Everybody's just more humble, you know, in their position to observe and then make a change for the better.
I love that. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, no problem. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Brian, thank you for this interview. I honestly am not sure where to start because there is a lot of really excellent discussion topics and things that Ji-yoon covered in this interview. But I really think it was really fascinating about her conversation and the way that she framed fundraising for her projects. It's the first time that I've heard an artist talk about fundraising the way that the development directors talk about their work. And, you know, talking about how it can access joy and, you know, bring joy to people by being able to support projects and to be able to support growth. And so I thought that that was a really great way for other artists to think about that and frame that. I know when I was first taught that by somebody in the development world, it helped me be able to be more comfortable to ask for money as well.
And additionally, with the crowdfunding sites, that like you don't get the money if you don't hit your goal. I think that's a really important thing for people to know about some of those crowdfunding sites, is that if you don't hit your goal, you don't get the money. It's not like, hey, you're partially funded. I'm sure you can still make an album with that. You're not funded at all at that point.
Yeah. And with that too, I feel like a lot of our episodes, we haven't really said this exactly, but in a lot of the ways in which we do business, and especially self-represented artists, is like trying to figure out how to make all of this work within the realms of capitalism. And Ji-yoon's story really kind of highlights how hard it is to be able to live and also create art if you don't come from a family who is already wealthy, or you don't already have those connections coming out of school. You know, we talk a lot about how in education now we're starting to teach artists how to be their own small business, and that if you are an artist, you still have to know all this business side of things. And that's a good thing that, you know, we're teaching now. It's still not the systematic issue that we're addressing, right? We're still trying to get around what the core problem is, and that it's just very hard to be so insanely talented to a point where I can't even begin to understand being that talented at the piano. They're not being places for you to perform without also knowing how to run a business.
Yeah, I think the realization for her of she wanted to play music and that's what she's good at, but then also having to be like, oh, I also have to market myself. I also have to do this stuff before you're like, oh, somebody else will do this. And the reality is that isn't always the case, and often is not the case.
And like, shouldn't artists that are that talented, like their job should be art?
On the opposite side, I feel like there's just such a catch 22 though, because from the presenting side, you know, we have financial obligations to fulfill and costs that we have to cover as well, right? So how can we take a risk on a artist that doesn't have huge name recognition or doesn't have an agency supporting them, someone that put them through that vetting process and has, you know, 100 performances under their belt? They're never going to get to that point unless someone like us takes a chance on them and puts them on our stage. But also, if they only bring in 10 people when we needed them to bring in 100 people to cover the cost of that show, then we're out too. So there's a real financial catch 22 in this situation. I don't know what the answer is. How do we as presenters give those artists a platform while also being responsible to our donors, our patrons, our community, our staff, all of those things?
Yeah, Katie, that's a real problem. And the reality is that it also most likely comes down to fundraising on the venue or the presenter side, to sort of be able to showcase those values and showcase either, you know, emerging artist or artist who isn't as well known in a certain region.
That's also our like long-term job too, is to bring artists like Jiyun in who is educating an audience in an area about, you know, this type of music or another type of music, and, you know, creating an audience in an area that knows more about it and is going to buy the tickets. And that's not something that just happens overnight.
And what you're all talking about has nothing to do with anything personal. And just like Jiyun's learned about and expressed, I love the way she put it, is that it's not personal, that maybe it's just not a good fit. In the long term, you're going to get more no's than yeses anyway. Even, you know, we're talking a lot about when you're new, but even when you're around for 20 years, you're going to get just as many no's. When Jiyun was talking about, okay, she came to the end of the rope getting her doctorate, and just thought everything was going to come to her, you know. And it's like the same thing's true when you have a 20-year career and you're a well-known name. Things don't just come to you. People think they do, but you have to work at it. You have to constantly put yourself out there and work at it.
Switching gears a little bit, I want to circle back to the conversation around tradition. And specifically, Jiyun said, classical music isn't the problem, the context is the problem. And it made me think specifically about growing up in West Michigan. The West Michigan Symphony has a conductor. His name is Scott Speck, and he's also the conductor for many other orchestras, including the Joffrey Ballet. And what made those experiences, say, tolerable as a teenager with not a lot of classical music education, because we don't teach about classical music in school, right? Even if you're in a choir class or a band class, like, you're not getting that classical music education necessarily. What made those experiences special, and I think helped propel me into an arts career, is that from the podium on the stage, he takes the time that Jiyun is talking about and talks about the piece ahead of time. And he will tell you what the inspiration is, what to listen to in the music. And it makes all the difference and gives you that appreciation. So I love what she had to say about that, and thinking about, like, how do we make this more accessible? That's an accessibility thing. That's not just an artistic thing.
And this simple thing of not exiting the stage and coming back on, because that's such a pointless tradition in so many ways.
Josh, I was thinking about that too. The first time when I was a kid went to a symphony performance, I did not understand what was going on. I was like, why are we clapping? Why is this person leaving? Like, what is it? I was very confused. I appreciate the way that she talked about both her degrees, in the sense that having the degree doesn't guarantee anything, and sort of talking about like what that actually gives you in life. And I thought it really segued nicely into when she was talking about the conversation on designing her life, and the way that she wanted to to live her life. It's a concept that I have often thought about, and it's something I always tell myself, like, I need to sit down and figure out what I really want out of my life. I've yet to do it, but it's mostly because I'm really fickle and can never decide what I actually want to do. But I do love the idea of it, and I think it's a great thing for people to do to sort of figure out what to aim for, or to be able to navigate their life a little bit differently.
So one of the things we didn't get into was how I got to really know Ji-Yoon. I met her at the Midwest Arts Expo in person, and that's where she introduced me to her podcast. And I really recommend it. It's Journey Through Classical Piano by Ji-Yoon Kim. They're nice bite-sized 15 to 20 minute episodes where she'll just tackle one piece, one classical piece with you. And I mean this as a compliment. I listen to those the way I used to watch Bob Ross, because she has such a calming voice. She explains it in such an accessible way that anybody can get it. And then she plays. And if you want to hear her play, I mean, it's incredible. I really highly recommend that, as well as her book. So I'm going to just end on something that she said about when she finds the right fit for getting the performance. She talks about you get the sparkles. And I just felt like that listening to her the whole time, that I got the sparkles from listening to all the amazing advice that she gave. And I hope you got some wonderful sparkles from it too. I want to thank Ji-Yoon for sitting down with me and having this conversation. And I hope you'll join us next time on There's No Business Like.
All right, everyone. Thanks for listening to There's No Business Like. Our producers and hosts are Brian Zelmer, Josh Benson, Kevin Maynard, Katie Miller, and me, Danielle Vanhoek. Views expressed in this podcast are ours alone and are not reflective of the organizations we are a part of. Keep up with us at nobusinesslike.com. There you'll find links to all of our episodes and socials. If you like this podcast, give us a like, a follow, a review, or our favorite, a 5-star rating. Oh, wait, what was that site? I got it, don't worry. It is nobusinesslike.com. Do I sound out bus-I-ness every time I type it? Yep, sure do. Stay in touch, my friends.
Hi, friends, and welcome back. I'm Brian Zelmer, director of KU Presents at Kutztown, Pennsylvania.
I mean, that's true.
That is actually.
Is that where you are?
Me, Brian.
I do podcasts.
This is not our first episode. Isn't
that amazing? Could have fooled me.
Hi, welcome back. Hi. Hi, guys.
Hi, Brian.
How did I liked how I started it, but then I tripped up on my intro.
It's because you tried to do two intros at once.
So what would your self-help book title be if you were to have a self-help book?
I think we would all agree the most appropriate title for my self-help book would be Everything Can Be Solved with a Spreadsheet, parentheses, One Mother's Way of Trying to Organize the Chaos.
I think mine would be Run From Your Problems.
Run, don't walk.
I mean, for me, I think it's going to be Screw It, Why Not?
Mine would be, I can't believe you wasted money on this book.
I feel like mine would be like, if you don't have something nice to say, make a joke about it. I feel like that's how I get
it. I love that.
That's not bad advice.
That's a baller title. Yeah.
Thank you to Pass Danielle, because normally when I'm like, do anything right, it's because I like prepared for it. And there are literally times I'll be like, well, thank God for Pass Danielle right now, because like I have to set up for myself to go, because current Danielle's not ready for this.
Most of the time I curse Pass Kevin.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes she is also not so great.
Make sure you see us next time.
Don't say it like that, because then you will say it.
Yeah,
that's definitely going to be your first take.
When you see us with your eyes on this podcast.
You have taken mushrooms.
I like mushrooms, especially in spaghetti sauce.
That's what she's talking about.
And on pizza. I love
Mario.
Pizza. In fact, I might get that for dinner. Thank you, Daniel.
You're welcome.